Hey there, IndyCar fans. This is Nathan Brown, your Motorsports Insider, here for another edition of IndyCar Weekly. We'll be chatting about the Long Beach Grand Prix. I was there. Stefan Wilson, my co-host, joining me today, was watching it from home. We have a lot of thoughts, a lot of things we were even just talking about here off air. We are excited to get into and we'll touch a little bit on the IndyCar race at Barber Motorsports Park coming up this weekend. But in case you missed it, another amazing victory for Scott Dixon. Another one of those that you just start scratching your head wondering how in the world he did it. I don't know anyone who knows other than Mike Hull and Scott Dixon themselves. He goes on an amazing fuel saving performance, puts together a pair of 34 lap stints at Long Beach while holding off the rest of the field, the likes of Colton Herta, Alex Palou, Will Power, and Joseph Newgarden, to go and take his 57th career victory, putting him 10 within AJ Foyt for IndyCar's all-time mark. We'll get into all of that here. Stefan, thanks again for joining me today. You're watching this race from home. You come away from the checkered flag. Is there anything other than marveling at Scott Dixon that you feel like led that race for you?
Yeah, I just, you know, you leave that going like, how is that possible? you know, 34 laps fuel saving and still able to run lap times strong enough to hold off not just Newgarden, but Herta on the last couple laps too. Just really impressive. Long Beach has to be one of the hardest places to save fuel to begin with. You know, you've got the hard acceleration from, you know, the slowest speed on the circuit, on the schedule of IndyCar, all the way up, and it's almost a mile long straight down in, you know, Shoreline Boulevard. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, it's a tough track to save fuel on. It leaves you very vulnerable at the end of that straight, and yet he was able to achieve it. You know, there's on a road course, there's a lot more flow, there's a lot less acceleration, so you can keep momentum up, save fuel a little bit easier, and he just was able to achieve those fuel numbers. And I think everyone is scratching their head. Everyone in the paddock is scratching their head this morning when you consider that him and Will Power were on the exact same strategy, and he finishes 15 seconds ahead of Will the finish. So that's the kind of domination that Scott put in on Sunday. I mean, you know, people, you know, we'll talk about, oh, he's not, yes, fuel saving win, you know, blah, blah, blah. But you still have to achieve the lap times and while you're saving that fuel. So, you know, think how fast he would have been if he wasn't saving fuel. Yeah, just really impressive. Yeah, not sure how he does it.
I was happy, I guess I would say, when we're watching this race on Sunday coming in. You know, with all the spectacle that the Grand Prix of Long Beach has, this was the 49th edition overall of this event. I think maybe the 40th IndyCar edition, and they're ramping up for the 50th next April. This event is called the, you know, IndyCar's version of Monaco for a reason. It's the second most important weekend on calendar from a race perspective. We had a weekend attendance of 194,000 fans, which, I mean, so many tracks on the schedule would love to have even half of. And yet the racing oftentimes isn't always the best or the most exciting. It very often comes to be this type of fuel saving race. And so it really depends on where those yellows fall. And where we had one on Sunday at lap 15, when Christian Rasmussen tapped the wall, I believe the lap before in turn 11, completely loses it coming out of turn 4. He spins, hits the wall, takes Jack Harvey with him there, although Jack was still able to continue on. This yellow flag falls, and these teams, without having had a yellow before that, are put in this really interesting position. Do you pit here and still try to make it home on one more stop after that? Do you stay out and just kind of try to continue on as a normal traditional two-stop race that this is? I'm wondering, as you were watching that, you know, before we saw who chose what position, what your thoughts were from a strategy standpoint on what you thought would make the most sense before we saw Scott do what he did.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up an interesting point. I mean, that yellow fell right in the window, or like right in the middle of the stint. So it was really a fork in the road. You could go either way with the strategy at that point. You know, if you're caught in some traffic that you think you're fast enough, then that's where you gamble and you take that pit stop and you switch strategies. You know, really, I thought at that point, okay, this is going to be really interesting just to see which cars take which route and how this shapes up. I think that really threw everything in the mix. Before, it was getting a little stagnant. Like you said, at Long Beach, it's so difficult to pass. I mean, you've got some really long straightaways, but a lot of the corners, the brake zone is just so short. So it makes it very difficult to really make a dive and make the passes on track. So, you know, I thought at that point, it was kind of unfortunate for Rasmussen, but it kind of really shook things up and kind of gave us the foundation for what ended up being a really exciting finish to the race. I mean, 12 laps to go. I mean, I just did not see that Dixon was going to win that race. I mean, you know, it's sitting at home. I was like kind of counting down. I wanted Dixon to win it. Just, you know, I want to see Dixon achieve the goal of you know, becoming the all-time winningest driver in IndyCar history. So I you know, I'm a little bit biased. So I was kind of counting down the laps, like, oh, come on, let's hold him off another lap. And I thought, there's just no way. I mean, 10 laps saving fuel, and with Newgarden looking as strong as he did all day right behind him, it just didn't seem like it was going to be possible. But he manages to pull it off. So
when you were doing the math, I mean, I'd have to go back to my notes and check and see, but I remember typing out and tweeting and putting in my notes for my story. Like, there was a point in there with 15, 20 laps to go where Joseph was lapping more than a second faster than Scott. Like, I think he had something around 7 to 10 seconds to make up in the span of like 20 to 25 laps. It was just like, how is this not going to happen? As you mentioned, it seemed like it was all made up for Joseph there. And then yet he gets behind Scott. And I know this isn't necessarily the easiest track to pass at, but if you get close enough on, you know, coming out of the hairpin, you have, as you mentioned, on Shoreline Drive, you have a mile to tuck up behind the number 9 Honda there of Scott and find your way to work around. And if you're Dixon, I don't think you're probably defending that too hard, because if you get to a point where Joseph is making an attempt to pass you with 10 laps to go still, and you see him have a great run, you're probably, with championship in mind, you're nursing that to the finish. You're just hoping, hey, you know, we
hold on to third or second.
Yeah. We qualified what, 8th this race. Yeah. We finished 2nd. That's a solid finish. It's a great points haul. We took this gamble and we jump from 8th to 2nd. I mean, that's a gain of what, 8th gets you 24 points, 2nd gets you 40. That's a gain of 16 points in the day. That's a solid jump. And yet Joseph could never get his way around him. He was within a second, or within a half second or so, within around 10 laps to go. And, you know, you wonder if that incident, if that incident with Colton Herd doesn't happen, does Joseph get another opportunity? I know they were coming on lap traffic, and that always complicates things when you're trying to get around guys. Dixon can kind of put a car in between them, as he did with, I think, Kiffin Simpson, his teammate, conveniently, and some other cars. That makes that pass a lot more difficult. So I don't know if he necessarily would have done it. And Joseph admitted it as much after the race, but you know, I wish we could have gotten a chance to see that. Maybe that's a good transition point to go into what you saw, what I've written about, what has been talked a lot about on social media about that contact that Joseph and Colton had there with 8 laps to go. I wrote in my story that published yesterday that Colton wouldn't have been surprised to get a penalty that would have involved him swapping spots with Joseph, or falling behind Joseph, I guess. So he would have fallen to 4th. Joseph would have jumped up to 3rd, and Alex Palou would have been in 2nd, assuming there wouldn't have been any other passes. We had a similar, somewhat incident earlier in the day, where Pato O'Ward ran into the back of his own teammate. Certainly not a purposeful thing, total accident, just like Colton's, and Pato gets a drive-through penalty. Rossi has to pit for damage. Look like it might ruin his day, although he climbs back up to 10th. What was your thought there on the penalty that we didn't see handed out to Colton?
Yeah, I'm honestly just shocked that wasn't a penalty, to be honest. I know the TV booth didn't really see a problem with that, but this has massive championship implications. Joseph's there running second, has a chance to go for the win, and all of a sudden the contact leads to him falling back two places. Not only does he lose another 8 points to Dixon, but he went from finishing ahead of Alex Palou and taking eight points out of his, well, he's not even leading the championship, is he?
He's not. Joseph actually is still.
Yeah. But still, he's probably going to be the rival at the end of the year. So taking 8 points out of his, or being 8 points ahead of Alex Palou, to finishing behind Alex Palou and losing 3 points. So it's 11 point swing in the championship because of that contact. And at the end of the year, there's 11 points could be vital. So, I don't know how that's not a penalty. I mean, it just, any contact like that that leads to one driver's day being completely changed. I have a hard time being okay with that kind of contact. And it opens up the door to just next year, okay, well, is this fair game now? Because, I mean, if you're behind someone, it's hard to pass at Long Beach. Are we just going to see people just punting people at the hairpin? I mean, it's a low speed, so you can time it and you can probably get it right and save your, keep your front wing intact. But I mean, that's the kind of precedent in our setting is like, okay, well, that's allowed. That's totally legal, when we're not going to do anything about it in race control. So yeah, that's a dangerous, rope to walk on. I think that's going to lead to issues down the road.
I know it's such a tough job, and I do not envy the folks that sit in race control. I know every single incident is different, but it seems like I know you don't want to penalize every single instance of contact because you want to have these guys able to, bump wheels, to tap, wings a little bit here and there to an extent. These cars aren't fragile like Formula One, where any amount of contact, you've got a piece of bodywork that's flying off. And we love that they can rub a little bit and you can see guys really, truly, have a gritty battle out there on track. We, think back to instances of like Barber a couple of years ago with Grosjean and Graham, several other instances. That's just the first one that comes to mind. Maybe because I'm heading to Barber here in a couple of days, but even though it was such a small bit of contact, and if it had come on a different part of the car that hadn't upset the gearbox and hadn't put Joseph into anti-stall mode, I know you don't want to be a reactionary on the effect of the contact instead of the contact itself, but I just have to think, like, at some level, if Joseph loses two spots literally because of the contact, I just have a hard time reasoning that in my head. And I know, as you mentioned, the booth guys said you have contact in this, in the hairpin all the time. It's incidental. It was a super small amount, and you don't want to get, I think that they ultimately said you don't want to get into being reactionary on waiting to see what the consequence of the contact was, rather than just saying this level of contact is inappropriate and should have been avoidable, therefore we're going to penalize it. I really felt for Joseph there.
I don't have an issue with them seeing what if that was an innocent bump and Colton admitted to it. It was a mistake. He misjudged it. He ran into the back of him. So if that happened and the position stayed the same, no penalty, no problem. So I think in that situation, viewing the consequences of the contact and then basing the penalty decision on those consequences, I think that would have been fine. As a driver, I think that's fair. like, hey, I messed up, you know, and my mistake cost the driver ahead of me two places. I could totally understand. I would totally understand myself receiving a penalty. So I'm just putting myself in their shoes. I think no one wants to see that, you know, penalty given based on consequences. But in this kind of situation, it's sort of like you could sort of treat this as a special case, you know, and any driver that's watching that, I would assume would also feel the same. Like, okay, that would be fair. A penalty in that situation would have been fair.
Yeah. I mean, think about, you know, if they give out that penalty after the fact where, as Colton described, I asked the question in the press conference, I basically said, were you expecting a penalty there? And his answer was, I would have been surprised if they gave me a drive through for that level. I would not have been surprised if they told me I had to go back behind Joseph, basically. Yeah. So that would have involved Colton going from second, dropping back to fourth. Joseph would have then moved up to from fourth, where he finished the race, to third, and Alex Palou ends up second. So if you think about where those cars were running at that moment, right before the contact happened, Joseph was second. He eventually, in this situation where Colton's penalized, he goes to third. Colton was running third. He goes from third to fourth. And, you know, Alex Palou jumps both of them and goes from fourth to second. Like, that, to me, with as incidental as it was, I would have, I don't know, I just feel like that's fair. Like, Colton, I don't know that you would even say that he took a risk. It was just more that he made a mistake, and you lose one spot and you lose 3 points in the championship. Joseph knows that stuff. It's a racing incident, essentially, and he loses one spot, and he knows that Colton's not going to race him that way. He knows that Colton wasn't doing that purposefully. And I just feel like all parties probably would have come away with that. Okay, obviously Chip Ganassi Racing would have loved it. Had a 1-2 finish after they won the IMSA race the day before. I don't know. I just
think that, you know, a lot of the times, you know, as drivers, we're always pushing the envelope, pushing the rules, mm-hmm. Looking for loopholes. And it's like, at some point, like, you need to be, you know, pegged back and being like, hey, this is not okay. And that was a situation where they had the opportunity to do that and sort of gain some control over the drivers. And, you know, we've seen it last year, like the amount of jump starts that didn't get called on road courses and ovals. Yeah. And it's like, if we don't do anything, then, like, if race control doesn't do anything, then the gloves just are completely off. And,
well, and we saw it arguably happen again in the heat race at Thermal.
Yeah.
Jumped, and that kind of ended up sparking the big crash that we had in turn one, lap one of the first heat between, you know, the eliminated Grosjean and Vique.
Yeah. So it's more about the precedent that it sets from race control. Like, yeah, you go, have at it, do whatever you want. And, you know, if the kids in the playground are not being supervised, then, you know, they're going to get up to mischief. So, you know, I think that was an opportunity lost to sort of, hey, that's not okay. So,
yeah. We'll do a quick rundown, not the full field. We can just kind of run through the top 10. As we mentioned, Scott Dixon starts eighth, finishes first, led nearly half the race, 42 laps, an incredible show of talent and grit from him and his timing stand to do what they did. Colton Herta finishes second, a strong start to the year after finishing, I believe, fifth at St. Pete at a race that was a little bit disappointing, given Andretti Global's strong form typically at St. Pete. Alex Palou finishes third. He currently sits fourth in points after, I think, finishing sixth or eighth at St. Pete. So right there, this is probably what I think I wrote it. Alex Palou finishes third, and I don't know what instance the broadcast would have ever had to talk about him the entire day. It was a very Alex Palou day. He continues his run of top 10s to, I think, 21 now consecutive finishes in the top 10. We don't talk about it enough about how incredible his consistency has been lately, and we'll have to see if it comes in the form of a repeat championship later on this year. Joseph Newgarden finishes fourth. Marcus Ericsson, a good rebound after a tough couple races to start the year with his new home, finishes fifth. Will Power drops back to sixth, the second best finisher, I believe, on that alternate strategy that won Scott Dixon the race. Kyle Kirkwood, solid, though somewhat a memorable day, finishing seventh after he started 10th. Romain Grosjean gains eight spots to jump to eighth with his new home at Juncos Hollinger Racing. Felix Rosenqvist drops a lot of that coming in the first 10 laps or so from his pole. The first pole from Eierschenk Racing goes from first to eventually finishing ninth. And Alexander Rossing, probably one of the hero performances of the day, starts 13th, drops all the way to last on lap one, and was able to climb back up to 10th by the end of the day. What of those, and I guess we'll extend it one more, and we can probably talk about him more a little bit more in a second. Teo Porcher, the defending Formula 2 champion, as a solid first couple of days of his IndyCar career, starts 22nd, has no issue, doesn't drop a wheel all day, goes from 22nd to 11th in a really strong, marvelous day for his debut. As we run through those guys at the top, what other performances or weekends do you come away either really happy with or maybe a little puzzled about?
I think the one I feel the most puzzled about is Felix. Starting on pole, what an amazing performance in qualifying, which he's been probably the most impressive qualifier this season so far. Starts on pole. Usually, if you've got a fast enough car in qualifying, like that usually translates to pace in the race. And just, you know, finishing ninth, I think that'd be a big disappointment for that team and for Felix himself. So I think that's the one that's really puzzling, especially when you consider how strong the race car was for his kind of pseudo teammates with, Herder, Ericsson, and Kyle even as well, you know, all finishing ahead of him, all starting behind him, you know. So, Ericsson, I thought, did a really good job to kind of pull that, you know, top five. He was kind of, you know, quiet all weekend, and then ends up running down the leaders and finishing fifth, but right there amongst the top four. So I thought that was a good sort of rebound performance for him after the first couple of races of the season. And I honestly, the one that surprised me the most was Rossi, because I kind of didn't hear his name all day, and until you actually just said he finished 10th, I hadn't even realized that. So, you know, after what happened at the very beginning of the race, I mean, that's a really good performance to be able to drag that car back to P10 from being 27th on lap one. So that's a standout performance and a good recovery drive for sure.
Felix, I know the team mentioned after the race that he struggled with, and I don't remember it specifically, but I know generally they called it just a brake issue. And I think Felix, in some quotes after the race, or maybe in a post or statement that he made, it sounded like just generally he wasn't able to dive, you know, take it deep enough into the corners like he typically would. So especially, I imagine, on those runs on Shoreline coming off the hairpin. I think that's a lot where he was losing some of those spots early. And he was back to probably sixth or so within the first 10 laps. And you're wondering, I mean, how bad is this issue or what's going on with him in the car? It's unfortunate, but for them, you know, I said this after he started second and finished seventh at St. Pete, like if your days at Eierschenk Racing of coming away super pissed off at the racetrack off on a Sunday night and you're finishing seventh and ninth, that shows how much progress both this team has been in the off season and how much Felix has been able to inject just kind of an energy or a new aura of life into this team. They've only been working together for a handful of months. Felix lives here in the central Indiana area. That shop is 3 hours away in Ohio, so he's only able to be there a handful of times. I know I talked to Mike Schenck a couple weeks ago, and he said that they didn't make a whole lot of changes to that team in this offseason. And when I heard that, if I hadn't seen how Felix performed in St. Pete and eventually in Thermal and now in Long Beach, I would have been a little worried, because they struggled so much these last couple years with Simon, especially, you know, even b- before his injury at Mid-Ohio last year. Struggled with Elio. I don't know that you're expecting to contend for championships with those two guys where they were in their careers, but I think Simon maybe finished 15th in the championship in year one and was clearly taking a step backwards before he had his incident that sidelined him for the rest of the year. So to hear them say that they didn't do a whole lot of shuffling around from a personnel standpoint, and to see what they've been able to do with the race car. Again, I know so much of that comes from their technical alliance with Andretti, and we've seen them start fairly strong outside of a couple gremlins with Marcus Ericsson the first couple weekends. That's a sign to me that team has gotten a lot stronger. I think they've gotten a lot stronger on pit stops. It's also a sign that I think Andretti is getting a lot better, and is also probably a sign that maybe Felix just has finally been able to direct the setup of a car that he just wasn't really able to during his 3 years at Aero McLaren. He obviously rebounded from a really, really tough year one, and I think finished, what, 8th in the championship maybe in year two and was 12th in year three. But when Felix came into this championship and finished, what, like 6th, I think, as a rookie in 2018, like, we had these really strong aspirations for what his career was going to be. I don't know that he's ever going to challenge for a championship with Meyer Shank Racing, but if he can factor into weekends week in and out, if he can be in fast sixes constantly, if he can rattle off a handful of top tens and finish like 6th or 7th in championship with a team that really struggled these last couple of years and has only been a full-time team in the sport since 2020, I think that would be probably arguably one of the performances of the year. We'll have to see how they perform on short ovals. I think that's the biggest concern, and was so this offseason. That extends all across Andretti Global, I believe. Mm-hmm. So there will be a point in this season, you know, once we get to this latter half and ovals are coming fast and heavy, I think will be a true test of where they really are. But I was bummed to see that for Felix. He's never finished better than 8th in a race where he has started on pole. He's had a tough run of luck.
Interesting stat. Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, the best one came his
Texas. Yeah,
no, it was his rookie year at the IMS Road Course. He starts on pole in 2018, finishes 8th. He started on pole at IMS. I think he finished 9th. He had two DNFs at Texas, and then last year at Laguna, where he started on pole, I think he finished like 18th or 19th, and I can't even remember, to be honest, what happened in that race. But whether it's self-inflicted stuff on his end or mechanical issues like we saw on Sunday, it just has not had good luck on days where he's had great Saturdays for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a crazy stat. I mean, when you think about how difficult IndyCar is, the level, getting those last couple attempts out of the car and yourself in the qualifying, and especially in the fast six, is really, it's the hardest part of the weekend, is I would say, in that fast six, because you're just pushing so hard, throwing caution to the wind, just trying to get every last 10th out of the car, and he's able to do that. So clearly, you know, he's had several poles now, and Saturday was definitely up there with, you know, a really, really strong pole position for him. And so it's crazy when you consider that, when he's doing the hard part and he's achieving that clearly pretty well. It's only going to be a matter of time, I guess, until that translates to race performance too. So
absolutely,
I'm sure it's something that it's starting to become a bit of a monkey on his back. It's something that he's gonna want to shake pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned there, we'll touch on him quickly before we wrap up. Théo Pourchaire, last year's Formula 2 champion. I think he was his third season in F2. He'd been a runner-up in F3. He'd be a champion in F4. He comes to IndyCar, had been in nothing more than a day in the simulator at Chevy on Friday. I think finishes practice maybe like 21st fastest, was around the same thing for practice 2, qualifies 22nd. And on a street course that we all talk about is always the toughest place to make your debut. And when we have this, you know, the season opener at St. Pete, so often we have rookies that are making their debuts on street courses. And We don't have to go. I mean, we can rattle off guys.
I know it all too well. I mean, I feel like I've lived Teo's life. I mean, I did Baltimore in 2013. I didn't do any practice. Basically, my first laps in IndyCar was at Baltimore, and that was a baptism of fire. So I fully sympathize with the challenge that he had, and he did an incredible job to be able to jump in IndyCar. You know, bear in mind, I mean, he's coming off of a couple of seasons in F2. The F2 car is, I would say it translates pretty well to an Indy car. A little bit less horsepower, but pretty close, and, you know, just as much aero. So I'd say that that's as good a training as possible to, you know, go make that transition from F2 to Indy car. But still, going to a circuit or a track that is, you know, a street course, so it's pretty challenging, especially into turn 9. Those bumps in the brake zone really throw you off. He's more used to driving, you know, super smooth, you know, FIA grade 1 tracks that Formula One race at. So
I'm even sure the first time... even on street courses.
Yeah, even on street courses, they're freshly paved. So I'm sure the first time coming down into turn 9 and hitting those bumps on the brakes, he's like, wow, this, we're not in Europe anymore. So he did a really good job. You know, I kind of was interested to see how he did, and was like, yeah, I remember that feeling of, oh wow, gotta learn an Indy car on a street course between walls. So yeah, I thought he excelled and really showed what he was made of, especially to just keep methodically working away at it the whole weekend. You know, just slowly improved, and then in the race just put a clean race together and finished 11th. So capitalized on some of his misfortune.
You mentioned your first race in an IndyCar was at Baltimore in 2013. What dating, you know, kind of going back to that, knowing other experiences that you've had and just being around the sport for as long as you have, how much more difficult do you feel like it is to have that debut be on a street course where you're basically running through tunnels? You've got concrete walls on both sides of you for just about, you know, every portion of every lap you're running, practice, qualifying, race, compared to running it on a road course where there's oftentimes there's grass, there's sand, there's gravel, mm-hmm. there's runoff. You have so much more room to make a mistake and still not get so punished for it. One of the things I wonder is, as you're in Teo's position, you're trying to learn yep. what the limit of the car is. You're trying to put it to that limit. You're trying to hit all your marks, and you're trying to also keep the car intact at the same time. You know that this team has been put through the ringer over these last couple months. The last thing you want to do is give them a mangled car on Friday night to have to put back together after your first practice. As a driver, how much more difficult is that to do on a street course than a road course that can be a little bit more forgiving?
Yeah, it was not by design for me to do my first race in IndyCar at Baltimore. You know, I did a handful of laps at Barber in the preseason test in spring, so in March. And then that was cut short because we had a gearbox problem. So I did a handful of laps. It was just really getting up to speed. And then it wasn't in a car of any kind until September for the Baltimore race. So it was, it was daunting. You know, you're trying to learn the car, you know, and to do that, you've got to push the limits and you've got to, you know, be pushing in the brake zones, etc. And rolling off the brakes, carrying speed through the corners, getting back to power. On a road course, you've got, you know, the edge of the track, and then you've got a curb usually, and then there's grass or gravel or some else that's a lot more friendly than a concrete wall. So you know, you can kind of push those brake zones a little later. Usually the brake zones are super smooth. You come to a street course and there's manhole covers, there's patches of concrete, you know, just because they're everyday roads that people are using all the time. So you know, it just makes everything a little bit more challenging, and each time you're trying to build this database of what it's like to drive an Indy car, and every lap, every corner, you're building that database mm-hmm. up. Every time you're trying to push it a little bit more, but the consequences of just going pushing a little bit too hard means that you're going to miss track time, miss valuable opportunities to keep building that sort of database, that bank of information that you're learning when you're behind the wheel of an IndyCar. So yeah, it was a difficult task for me back in 2013, and you know, I think Teo did a fantastic job at the weekend, just to keep a clean, have a clean car the whole weekend, didn't put a foot wrong, and you know, just had a nice clean race and moved up positions and finished P11, which I think that's a pretty solid day for him, and getting the opportunity to be back in the car now at Barber, it's going to present a different challenge. I think, you know, the Barber is probably one of the toughest places to drive an IndyCar, to be honest, just because the elevation changes, the compressions, it sort of really increases or maximizes the strength needed to drive the IndyCar. Like the G-forces are probably double, maybe triple what you experience at Long Beach, you know, going through turn 15, 16, through that fast right-hander, you're going to be pulling close to 4 Gs. So it's a different kind of challenge that he's going to face. It's really going to test his fitness for sure. I think, you know, if he's used to driving F2, I think F2's, I think it has power steering.
They do.
So yeah. They're, you know, it's just not going to be, he might not be prepared physically. I'm just speculating here. I have no idea if his training program or anything, but I just know that people that have come into an IndyCar, when they drive at Barber, they're getting the full experience of how tough and how physical an IndyCar is. And he's definitely going to experience that. You know, just 80, is it 80 laps on Sunday?
That sounds right.
That's a long time. Mm-hmm. A lot of laps, and you know, that's his neck, his arms, you know, they're going to need to be in really good shape.
90 laps, 207 miles, 90 laps on Sunday at Barber. Yeah. I know he's been here now in the States almost 3 weeks. Actually, I think exactly 3 weeks.
I bet Tony's had him, you know, do some curls and, you know, do it.
I bet.
Get him on the bench press. I'm sure Tony's got him whipped into shape already.
It'd be interesting to know, and to know maybe how early after David's crash those conversations between McLaren and Sauber began. You know, if there was a, you know, he's racing in Super Formula this year. He had his first race, I can't remember when, I think it was sometime in March. So obviously he was getting ready. He was race fit, but a Super Formula car, I don't know if those have power steering or not. I'm going to feign ignorance on that one, but my guess is probably yes, similar to a Formula 2 car.
I don't know either, but I'm pretty sure.
So my guess is, you know, maybe he'd been at most getting ready for this for a month. Now, is that enough time to build strength and then let your body recover before you get to Long Beach and now Barber? I don't know. I imagine he probably got a little bit stronger in there, but you know, is that enough to withstand 4 Gs for, you know, 90 times over that fast section at the end of the track at Barber? I don't know. But I'm interested to see. I think he was already talking when he stepped out of the car on Sunday about being a little sore, about not wanting to move too much because his body was just really spent. And so having to do that on Sunday and then 5 days later be back in the car on Friday for practice. Again, practice is very different than a race. You're maybe only running 25, 30 laps at most. But I'll be very interested to see if he can throw together another top 12 performance at Barber.
I'll go on record. I'm willing to bet that he makes it out of round one in qualifying. I reckon he's going to be in the top 12 in qualifying. I would say misses out on fast six just by a bit. I reckon he's going to be about P7, P8 on the grid. No, you know, his experience, his background is all is road courses. To win in F2, it means he's a really high caliber driver on road courses. To be racing a super formula translates really well to an IndyCar. So I reckon he's going to excel and really, you know, now he's had a weekend under his belt driving at Long Beach. Yeah, I'm willing to bet P8, top eight in qualifying.
Okay.
Let's see how I do on that prediction. But I agree. I think he gets into, I mean, he's good all the way through to the race. And then in the race, it's really going to tax him. You know, I think the short sessions in practice, you can sort of maintain, you manage that fatigue on your arms. But then once you get into the race and it's 90 laps, just back to back, and there's not usually many yellows at Barber. So, you know, it's going to be a hard day for him, but I mean, he's a professional. I think he'll be fine.
Yeah. We saw kind of a similar example of what you just touched on. I mean, Christian Lundgaard's debut in IndyCar in 2021 goes to the IMS road course, qualifies fourth, but I think drops back to 10th or 12th by the end of the race, kind of that type of thing you're talking about.
Yeah.
Able to manage his way throughout the weekend, a lot of speed at a track where that team is typically very strong, is able to hit all of his marks, do really well in qualifying, and then just maybe doesn't quite have it through the race. I could see something very similar. I know this Arrow McLaren team is very excited to get on road courses because I think they were street courses was a place where they were a little concerned about their potential performance, and they get a second place out of Pato at St. Pete's. And then, you know, I know their best finish at Long Beach is 10th from Alexander Rossi, but I would imagine, you know, Pato having led practice on Friday, that's great. What they did in qualifying was puzzling and disappointing, to not have any of those three cars in the Fast 12, a little odd. So I imagine if you would have told them maybe coming into these two, you get one podium out of these first two races, they might have taken it. So I'll be excited to see. This is a race that Pato won a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I think he was in the top four or five last year at Barber. So interested to see. I think this could be a strong track for them. So as you mentioned, I'm interested to see how he physically can deal with this. We'll touch on David's situation real quick, and then we'll finish up here. Really, really feel for him. I've kind of been sensing this as we've been away from the track for a month or so, and you haven't been getting a whole lot of updates. I know there was some positivity that he gave me a sense of when we were at Thermal. That was March 22nd, 23rd. So literally a month ago, he thought he was going to be running Long Beach. He was planning to get his pins out within a week. Everything about his recovery and his rehab process, his physical therapy, was on track from what the doctors had lined out for him when he had his surgery on February 13th. And can't say for certain exactly what has happened in this last month to set him back, but the best way to map it out is he still has those pins in his wrist. He's getting them out tomorrow. We're taping this on Tuesday, 2 days after the race. He's scheduled to get those out on Wednesday. Earlier this morning, as we mentioned, they did confirm that Teo will be in the number six this weekend at Barber. But they've known for a while. I mean, they wouldn't say it, but they've known for a while that David was not going to be running at Barber. It will be very, very critical on if he does or does not see the car in May on how these next 2 weeks go. With those pins in his wrist, his wrist has been immobile. Essentially, he's been able to move his fingers. He can carry stuff. He can, work out his forearms, work out his upper body in some effects, but that wrist has been completely immobile. And so that means that all of those tiny little muscles in that wrist area have not been able to get worked out. They're weak. They're weak from the injury. They're weak. Those tendons are weak from getting repaired. But that area, essentially for a race car driver where you have power steering, he hasn't been able to work out in more than 2 months. 2.5 months probably at this point. And that's tough. Probably imbalanced a little bit, 'cause I imagine he's been keeping the right side of his body fit. And so you're put in an awkward spot there. But I mean, I could tell from talking to his parents on the grid on Sunday at Long Beach, I think there's hope that he might be able to be back for the 500. But if you're not back for the Sancio Grand Prix on May 11th, if you can't say without a shadow of a doubt, I can handle a car on May 10th and May 11th, how can you be certain that you can handle a car on May 14th when we start Indy 500 practice up a couple days later? I know those are different beasts. I know there's probably a level of, you know, maybe they get in a situation where, hey, we're confident that David can, you know, can turn left on IMS, but we just don't want to take a risk on a road course because we're betting on him to be in a car. Mm-hmm. And the last thing we need is for him to crash. And then we don't have a backup option because we're just planning on him being in the car. I don't know.
If he's going to get back in a car at some point, I would say, like, just coming from a driver's perspective, mm-hmm. probably that Grand Prix is probably the best opportunity for him to get back in a car. Okay. Like, on the schedule, it's probably one of the easier tracks physically, you mm-hmm. know? So if you're going to do that, it's also a shortened weekend. It's a little shorter than typical. I'm hopeful. I got a lot of respect for David. I think he's a really talented driver. I was excited to see what he was going to do this year. I'm hopeful that he gets back in the car for the GP. And if he doesn't, then as a driver, I know, unless the team are really taking a hands-on approach here and they're deciding what's happening, there is not much that, you know, my wrist could be falling off and I'd still be getting in that car for the 500. So I find it highly doubtful to believe that he's not going to be behind the wheel of that number six, come the Indy 500. I mean, there's last year I broke my back and I was still trying to race the car. So I feel like at some point, he's just gonna be like, I'm not missing out on driving a car that is capable of winning the Indy 500. I'm not missing out. So I would, again, bold prediction here, but I would definitely say he's back for the. I think he's back for the GP. He's definitely back for the 500. So
I imagine maybe it comes down to, and this comes down to what Aaron McLaren's approach to this situation is, and we don't entirely know, but like. Are you willing to put David in the car when you aren't certain he's 100% ready to be back in the car? That might be what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. He might be.
Yeah, if they're taking a hands-on approach and being the kind of dictating that, based on what the doctors are telling them. Yeah,
because you can hop in a simulator, that has everything turned on full boost, and it's still not going to totally replicate that. I mean, that can get you ready. That can check and see where on the spectrum between 70 and 100% you are. And I'm sure mm-hmm. he's probably doing that. But I guess I just wonder, are they willing to put him in the car to see if he's ready? Or do they want to know without a shadow of a doubt that he's ready? I know they're getting, there's pressure from sponsors. They want results. They want the guy that they signed up to be in the car. But they also don't want someone in the car where you got a lot of people asking questions like, is he ready? Is he back? Is he going to be, is he set out for this? So I definitely wouldn't be surprised to see him in the car. I know Teo said that he was asked to do two races. Callum Ilott cannot do the Sanzio Grand Prix. So if David is not ready yet, then it's probably Teo's to do. Extreme, maybe in some way. I guess they probably assumed, hey, these first two are not going to be doable, and then we'll maybe kind of see how these next 10 days go and figure out who we want in the car. I don't know enough about this injury to know how realistic, going pins out to less than 2 weeks or I guess it'd be two weeks to be in the car and be back going.
The reason to not do the GP is, like you said, if they're, as we've all seen in the IndyCars, the last sort of 5 or 6 years, a common injury has been to do with the wrists. You touch a wheel and that because there's no power steering, that energy gets transferred through the wheel. And that could be some of the risk of like, hey, let's not rush this. I think at the 500, I think that goes away a little bit. The shunts, if you have a shunt, it's pretty big, but you're typically at that point, your hands are off the wheel. So it's not like you're going to get those clumsy sort of wheel touches where it grabs the wheel and it's, that's what breaks the wrist. So yeah, I think some of that risk goes away a little. And I would say, yeah, I mean, as a driver, if he's dictating whether he gets back in the car or not, then I don't see him missing the 500. But
yeah, and I don't know how much of that dictating he's doing. I guess we can just leave it there.
I'm speculating. You know, I don't even know much about the injury. I just know that it, you know, coming from a driver and a driver's perspective. So
a lot going on in that team. They're trying to get to, you know, they're trying to keep sponsors happy. They're trying to think what's best for David. They're trying to stay competitive. It's, you know, I talked to Tony Kanaan a couple times this weekend, and he's kind of running point on all of this. This is not what he signed up for, as the sporting director of Air McLaren. My thoughts also go out to him, cause I know this has been a really stressful time, and he's, you know, he's having to play some weird roles where he's, you know, trying to help David along while also giving David some bad news and helping the person that's replacing David along. You know, he's been spending a ton of time with Teo, getting Teo ready for this opportunity. It's a weird place. I think it just comes down to, you know, do you put David in the car for the Sanseo Grand Prix when you're not sure where he is? Or are you comfortable, if that's not okay, are you comfortable with his first laps in a car being back, being practice for the 500? Because then if you find out that things still aren't totally right, then you've set off this media frenzy, and you've also got to go, you know, have, you know, Callum fly back over from Europe if he's not already on the ground, which wouldn't surprise me.
Callum can stay in England. I'll be on site in India.
There you go. Stefan throwing his hat in the ring here. It'll be very interesting to see how these things go. I think we'll have our answer on obviously who's running the car once we get to May 14th, but how they get to that answer over these next 3 weeks will be really interesting. We will leave it there. We will have another episode next week, same day, same time, Tuesday after the race at Barber Motorsports Park. Be a fun string of a couple weeks here with episodes after every race. Appreciate all of you for tuning in, listening. Please, if you're enjoying this, download, subscribe. Really, really helps us leave a 5-star review, trying to build this up. Really appreciate the following that this platform has had. Appreciate all of you that have been reaching out at the racetrack on social media, saying that you enjoy it. Share this with some of your IndyCar fan folks, if you know that they'd already listened to it. We enjoy doing it, having an outlet for both of us to chat a little bit about IndyCar in between this crazy stretch of on-track activity over the next couple months. Anything else, Stefan, before we take off?
No, I mean, you hit everything. I think, I usually critique the broadcast, and I would say the NBC crew did an amazing job this weekend. I think they did a really nice job of staying focused on the race. And from the viewers at home, at least from my perspective, it was a truly exciting race, and they did a great job of capturing it all. So kudos to everyone involved.
Some really cool strategy stuff there on the broadcast we'll see if that's used again. We could maybe get into next week. Well, that's it for this week's episode of IndyCar Weekly. I'm Nathan Brown, your motorsports insider. Head over to IndyStar.com. We'll be having lots of coverage still, recapping this weekend's Long Beach Grand Prix. I will be on the ground at Barber Motorsports Park on Thursday for the race weekend there, and we will have a lot more for you next week on next week's edition of IndyCar Weekly. Thanks for listening.